SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
I couldn't be religious and gay. It was impossible.
I was being marketed as some sort of like teenage it girl.
When a girl kissed me on my 18th birthday, a whole other world opened up to me.
I was a minor nuisance.
8 Australians will tell you about the choices that have led them to unexpected places.
These are some of the stories you will hear on Let Me Tell You, a podcast where real people tell incredible real stories.
Look for Let Me Tell You and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
You're a handmaid.
I was.
That's how they threaten us. If we're fruitful with the red dress and the wings. I don't know how you could give your baby up to somebody else.
I'm trying not to.
You don't own me. I'm not your property. So take a shifty little beady eye over me.
Women are finding their own way of expression through utilizing that costume in their own way. So it's beautiful.
Welcome to Eyes on Gilead. Today we're going to be talking about episode 3 of season 2, and a special treat, we are going to be talking to the costume designer of the Handmaid's Tale series, Anne Crabtree, so do stick around for that. And I've got to say, we go into quite a lot of detail about each episode on this show, so do bear that in mind if you're sensitive to spoilers, because we are going to spoil. My name is Fiona Williams, and I'm Managing Editor of SBS Movies and TV Guide here at SBS, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Sana Kadar and Natalie Hambly.
Hello.
Hi.
I am a journalist at Small Business Secrets. My name is Sana, and I am loving the series so far.
I'm Natalie, and I am the Managing Editor of SBS Life, and absolutely agree, 100%.
And we've just watched episode 3 of season 2, and I don't know about you guys, but I need to debrief, and maybe I need a little bit of a hug, and possibly a deep drink too.
It started off really uplifting with the music and the running, and I was like, okay, things are happening, things are changing. It sure as hell did not end that way.
Yeah. Yes.
Actually, this episode was like the reprieve that I think that we needed after episodes 1 and 2, and I had this sort of line which I thought, No, Handmaid was harmed in the making of this episode, and I really needed that. And we also had a reprieve from Aunt Lydia. She was barely in this.
Yeah, it was a flashback of her. Yeah, it wasn't.
And as much as I love, hate that character, and I think the actress is amazing, I also was very glad to not see her much this episode.
It was a nice break. But I found what was interesting in the sort of opening sequence when she's running through the Boston Globe offices at night. Her voiceover says, my mother says it's incredible what women can adapt to. And June is very much sort of looks like she's adapted to living in what she formerly described as a slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
So remarkable indeed what she can adapt to.
2 months.
That's
like,
right.
I was a bit surprised. I was like, wow, 2 months has gone by. And I absolutely loved that sort of training, opening scenes of her running around the printing area. Up the stairs, down the stairs, she's got like trainers on. And I thought, yes, she's gearing up for a fight. This is exactly what I want to see.
I think she was taking a leaf out of what you suggested last week in the episode.
She heard me, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she's got some time on her hands, so now she's squaring for
a fight.
Although
I always wonder, where is she getting food? Where how is she eating and
I think delivery man was bringing it. He mentioned not dropping off this time. So, yeah, I thought the exact same
good
thing.
Call.
Yeah, 2 months and she's got a baby on the way. Just a quick recap of episode 3. So June has spent 2 months hiding out in the former offices of the Boston Globe, working on a cardio and reading old newspapers around the office to build a timeline of Gilead to sort of get a sense of how we got here in the hope that maybe how we get out of this. But then she's on the move again and things do not go to plan. Her safe house is declared unsafe, so she can't go there, and she relies on the kindness of a couple of strangers in a bid to try and make a plane, a little puddle jumper, as they call it, to get over the border to Canada. But as she prepares to leave, and there's a lot of waiting around in this episode for her, June recalls the relationship with her own mother and their mutual disappointments in each other, and that dredges up the guilt that she herself is feeling about getting out and leaving her own little daughter Hannah somewhere out there in big old bad Gilead. So doesn't end on a great moment.
It's quite suspenseful.
It is quite suspenseful.
I think it's quite clever, though, because I think we sort of... There's a tendency, I think, to open up these episodes and feel a bit of dread about what's coming. But the way they've ended this one, you really want to watch the next one. Like, it really has sort of amped up that anticipation of, is she going to be okay? What's going to happen next? Which I think is quite clever. I think the series needs that, actually.
Yeah, oh, it's great. Yeah, it ends on a cliffhanger, so it's, yeah.
It's also been really nice to sort of get more glimpses of how Luke and Moira's life is proceeding over in Toronto. And there's a sort of a real casualness and closeness to their interactions at the apartment. Who, by the way, is the other roommate? Do we know? Who's that blonde girl?
She was introduced, I think it was the last episode of season one.
Okay.
But she hasn't said anything, and then she has one line.
Yes.
Blessed be the Fruit Loops.
But here we get a sense of how Moira is coping, or rather not coping, with being out but haunted by what happened and what
she's been
through.
Interesting that she was at a club, because that was what her job was back in
Jezebel.
Gilead.
Using the name Ruby. Yeah.
And she was using Ruby, yes. I thought,
I completely missed that. That's right.
She hasn't left that behind.
Yeah.
So it's been 2 months, and clearly they are getting on with life to a certain extent in Canada, but we don't know quite how well they're going. But yeah, there's still all those like shades of history there for her. So yeah, I am curious. I hope we get to see a little bit more of them every week.
Same. I didn't think it was more of a snapshot of Moira's life, and it was a bit of a shortcut. At first she's working in the asylum seeker centre as well, welcoming new arrivals and recommending them to the therapist upstairs, and you get the sense she's not made use of those services because she's putting on a brave face and she's laughing at home and going for a run as well, simultaneously to June running around Boston Globe, Moira's running around Canada. Not the whole country.
Actually, she's running around Allen Gardens in Toronto, where I spent many a skipped class during university.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I noticed that landmark. But
thank you, local knowledge helps here. But clearly she's just not coping all that well. You know, she has a hookup in the bathroom at the club, but it's not reciprocated. So
I did like about when she saw that refugee and was helping him. We actually finally got a sense of what life is like for the men of Gilead. Because really, like, season one is really all about what happens to the handmaids, and we don't really find out what happens to the rest of society. And we finally have got a bit of a glimpse of what it's like to be a man in that world. And the guy that she was helping, he said that he got turned into a guardian, which was kind of their version of the army and having to enforce violence, really. And he was traumatized by it. And I thought, so that's what's happened to some of the
men. And he was a gay man as well.
And then had to hang his, you know, college sort of boyfriend on the wall, which is awful. And actually, I really liked how that scene was filmed, because the camera sort of stayed on Moira and her reaction while he was, saying his story. And the way she flinches as he talks was just so – it was interesting to see – Moira and how she's experiencing that story of horror, because she's, of course, been through her own horror.
Yeah.
I think the other thing we saw this episode is the life that June could have had.
Yes.
Was the, what do they call them? The
Econo people.
Which is so weird, right?
Why? Yeah. I mean, that comes from the book, but I don't know what that's.
Like, it's not flattering, is it? No one wants to be that. But I think I'm assuming that's what the life for her would have been like if she hadn't tried to escape with her daughter.
Yeah. And she remarks about that in her voiceover. She says, so this is where I could have ended up if I was an adulteress, if I had played my cards right, if I had known I had cards to play, which was kind of really scary.
And what a depressing life, though, you know, like, it's not really a great option either. Look, they're all bad options, and I certainly don't kind of want to rank them from best to worst, because they're all awful. But it was a very drab life. Like, she entered into the home of one of the men who was helping rescue her, and you sort of really get the feeling that no one feels safe there. They feel like they're watched all the time, and the family leaves the house to go to church, but they're only going because they have to for performance reasons.
And what I found interesting was the wife, that Connor wife, kind of sort of shits on June a bit and judges her for being in a position she never chose. And it sort of comes after we see the flashback scenes of June and her mother, where her mother is sort of shitting on her life choices as well. So I'm like, June just can't win in any corner of her life, really.
She really can't. And it does show the paranoia and the insecurity and the fear within women who are able to give birth to children that, God, we might be roped into being handmaids, and just the risk of that and just the judgment that comes with that too.
I actually thought it was a sign of how little information is getting out there, because that woman was very judgmental and sort of mean to June in a way that I thought, I don't think she understands the horrors that they are undergoing. She seems to think that June has a choice. Like, she says to her that, I just can't imagine having to give up my baby. I think I would die first. And I thought, do you realize they're getting their eyes plucked out and they're getting like maimed and tortured?
Yeah, and it's like, not a voluntary position.
Yeah, if you knew what they were going through, I don't think that you could treat them like that. And so I'm thinking, is this...
But equally, who's talking about it?
Yeah, because they have no free press. We know that, yeah. You know, so I think maybe they don't know.
In series one where the presentation when the Mexican dignitaries were coming over and June had to play the good handmaid and make presentations. So, you know, imagine all the press is... We're doing this for country, love of country.
That's actually interesting because the guy who sort of picked her up from that shed full of signs and eventually took her back to his place, on the way, you know, as he was about to rescue her, his phone buzzed and he said, oh, no, the safe house isn't safe. Mm. And I thought, a phone. Mm. Why are there not more contraband phones flying around here? Because in a couple of flashbacks, we've seen June handling an iPhone. So clearly this is sort of a contemporary, near future setting that we're in. And in social media, obviously the book was written far before social media became a thing. But it just, I thought, hang on, actually, if this was perhaps a more real representation of the current era in which we live, social media would be a thing, helping Gilead both sort of keep track of who's done what and get information on people, but then also helping people who've escaped perhaps contact their loved ones. But anyways, they haven't
clearly
sort of explored
that
region.
It's like totally agree. And I think really they've sort of missed a great chance because for the last 2 months, June and Nick could have been sexting the whole time.
Oh, that would be great to watch.
And just to place it in a timeline as well, I mean, we had the Friends episode last week to suggest a level of time and an iPhone. And this week, in a flashback, June mentions that she wanted to marry Jordan Catalano from My So-Called Life. So that sort of places her age a little bit.
Which
she'd be...
I have to say, placing my age, I had to Google and I was like, who's
all right.
That?
Yeah, I'm actually not sure either.
I'm showing my age here. Oh, yeah, that was Jared Leto's character in My So-Called Life.
Yes, I've since realised.
Right. But of course, in the middle of this episode is June's relationship with her own mother and how much that informs her and the woman that she became and what she owes to her mother, the... complicated relationship they have that she has to reconcile if she hopes to get her head straight in this crazy world.
I felt so bad for her because her mother, like in this episode, she, which was a flashback before June was about to get married to Luke, and her mother was so disapproving of her life choices. She disapproved of the job she had, which like she was really rude about.
And being editors also, she, you know, called it, you're basically looking at other people's work for typos.
Yes, I was like, way to present it in the worst light
possible.
That's
a bit reductive. Okay, Mum, thanks.
Well, her mother, you know, was an abortion doctor and like a supercharged agitator and activist in the community.
Which I think is a return to a storyline from the book as well.
Yeah, I believe so. I didn't finish it.
I'm sort of actually reading it now, but only halfway through. So slowly getting there.
Can't rush these things. And when we see her take June as a child to a ceremonial burning of the names of rapists, so that was a supercharged moment. And her mother's friends are unimpressed with June's career until... It's mentioned that she did a blog for, what was the website that she did? I don't know. There's something that impresses them.
But basically, like her mother is such a feminist activist that I don't think June could ever meet up to her expectations.
Yeah.
But I think it adds a layer of guilt for June because when she's going back, she says, like, my mother saw this. She knew this was coming. And her mother was annoyed with her for not protesting enough, for not fighting enough, and for just having this nice life.
But
it was
despite
a distraction
her fight,
to get married.
We still find out sort of what happened to her mother in a flashback, and we see her photo flash up, and she's in the colonies.
In the colonies.
And so, you know, her feminist fight hasn't worked out very well for her either.
Yeah. Which just leaves June with so much guilt, you know. Now she's seeing like her daughter's being taken away, her mother's in the colonies, her mother warned her of this years ago and June didn't do anything about it.
I don't know
it.
How the girl keeps going, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, I just think that's such a testament to her mother because even though her mother doesn't realise that her daughter is an activist, June clearly is. Like she is such a strong character.
Yeah.
She has not given up. She hasn't been broken or beaten emotionally. I mean, you know, she's still rather than running off to her room and crying, she's actually frequently angry and defiant, you know. So,
although there was also a line at some point, again, I think from the man who picked her up and took her to his home in, eventually, where he says, we're all either brave or stupid. And I thought that is such a perfect summary of how June actually acts in this episode, because she, even when she's in the safe, in the house, safe, she's peeking out the window.
Oh my God, that drove me crazy.
What are you doing?
And then, holding marbles. And I thought, oh God, a marble's going to drop on the floor.
And when she's on the train, sort of, when she's left the house, she's whipping out her map of Massachusetts with the girl behind her looking at
Well, we
out.
Need like, these moments of drama, though.
What are you doing? This is stupid. Infuriating. This is no longer brave.
Yes, but in that house where there is a knock on the door and it's, oh God, time's up, but she races under the bed and finds a prayer mat.
And a Quran.
And a Quran, And she smiles and pulls out the prayer mat, and it's sort of like, ah, even here where they seem to be so under the eye, you know, there's still these little moments of resistance and holding on to something that used to be.
Yeah, that was totally unexpected.
And with June, even at the start where she has to spend 2 months in the office here, she's using her time wisely and keeping her mind active by going, she's in a newspaper headquarters, so she's going back over the old copies of the newspaper to piece together a timeline of Gilead. And you see, you know, she's cut things out. She's got the wall going under subheads of, you know, she's listening to old dictaphone tapes of interviews just to try and understand how this happened.
When they were close up on it, and one read, another night of protests, and another one read, we're doing this for your protection, which I thought, isn't that the most perfect sort of parallel to whenever there's a terrorist event and sort of privacy and all those issues sort of come up with monitoring of social media and electronics and all that kind of thing.
Even on a smaller scale, sort of in health legislation and whatnot, you know, for your own benefit, and things can be framed that way so that people might be more amenable to a change.
But what I really loved this sequence, because I think if there was a message for the viewers in this episode, I think that's where it was, which was June's going back and she's now looking at all the signs they missed. So she's going back through all the old articles to see hints of the Gilead to come, which she clearly missed because she wasn't an activist at the time.
Her mum saw it.
But her mum saw it, If there's a message here, it's like, listen to the feminists. You know?
Exactly.
They know.
Yeah, and the points that she's framing them under, she's cutting out old articles and putting them under subheads of curtailing of civil rights, power structure, militarisation. So she's just looking at all the little clues that got her to where she is.
And can I just say on that point is that with having Handmaid's Tale swirling around my head this week, it has actually changed the way that I'm seeing the news as well. I feel like I'm seeing Handmaid's references coming up all over the place, and not just like actual literal references, but also just stories which don't mention the show at all, but are a little bit disturbing. And I think as kind of a good exercise, if anyone's in the mood for it, is to just pay attention to the news next week and just have a look at what you're actually seeing and sort of think about what other signs that are out there, because I think they are out there. What other signs that are out there that we are possibly missing?
And
share them with us on Twitter. Find us.
And they were out there 30 years ago when the book was written. And I think with what Margaret Atwood has done so well is, you know, people do say, oh, it's so outlandish, some of the things they do, but most of them have roots in history, whether it's medieval history or, you know, Third Reich or current day.
Absolutely.
Yeah, or events in third world countries. There is an element of truth.
Which is what makes it so effectively scary.
So eerie, and it can be so real. Well, even, you know, with these episodes that have taken place in a newspaper headquarters, and this week we did see the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which is the big precedent in Washington, and there was that enormous kerfuffle over the comedy routine of Michelle Wolf speaking truth to power and just calling the journalists as well on enable Trump. So that, you know, that was...
You've enabled this dystopia.
Exactly. And yes, she referenced the smoky eyeshadow, but she said a lot more too, and it's a great routine if you want to go and
I actually look that up. Screamed when she referenced Aunt Lydia.
Yes, I actually did. It was great.
Because what a burn. Like, that is such an insult, isn't
it? You do not want to be Aunt Lydia.
You don't want to be Aunt Lydia.
And of course we have Sarah Huckabee Sanders. We are graced with Sarah's presence tonight. I have to say I'm a little starstruck. I love you as Aunt Lydia in The Handmaid's Tale. Mike Pence, if you haven't seen it, you would love it.
So one other thing we saw this week when June was spending time with the Econo people hiding out in the house there, a new wardrobe / uniform / what?
Mood.
Well, 50 Shades of Grey.
The
identifying outfit of the Econo people.
Very, very drab, very bland, very economic.
And I think that when June does don the robes of the wife and is out in the street, you know, it's an invisibility shield, really, because she's terrified at first and just sort of watching and scanning to see if anyone notices her. And then she realises, actually, no one's looking at me because I'm just in this nothing outfit and I'm just going about my daily life as a noble citizen of Gilead.
Yeah, like the costumes really denote who in the world has importance. Because even the handmaids, while they have a very terrible position they occupy, they're in those striking red robes. That can't be missed.
Yeah.
And the wives are in their sort of beautiful blue robes. But the Marthas and sort of the aunts as well, they're all very drab looking in what they wear. And the Econo people sort of fall into that landscape. They're sort of nothing people in a way almost.
In the hierarchy. And I do enjoy towards the end here when June does get to her pilot, he says, well, where's your robes? Prove you're a handmaid. And thinking that somehow she's escaped across Gilead in her identifying red flowing robes.
It's exactly like, come on.
Yeah, come on, buddy. There's a scar on my ear that we'll have to do. Speaking of the costumes of The Handmaid's Tale, I was lucky enough to speak to Anne Crabtree, the costume designer of the series, to talk about just what it's like to design these outfits that actually do identify your characters. So, she's fantastic. So let's have a listen to that. Anne Crabtree, thank you so much for joining us on Eyes on Gilead.
Oh, hey, how's it going?
Oh, very well.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, clothes are always important in a project, but here, you know, in the world of Gilead, where the clothes define you, what was the guiding principle in creating the looks for the show?
For season one and season two, I look first to Margaret Atwood's beautiful novel because that's what inspired me as a young lady. That's why I took the job, and it is the beautiful construct from which all stories and costumes come. So that's the first place. And then from there, you know, there's tons of research, obviously from historical clothing, but also I look to nature and paintings that inspire certain environments and even, you know, current clothing and industrial clothing for Gilead. All of those seem to come up all the time with every new section or storyline.
Perhaps maybe if we go through some of the defining characters in the show, say let's start with The Handmaids, obviously that iconic look of the robe and the red dresses. Can we talk about that? And obviously there was strong source material, but how did you interpret that and how did you make it your own here?
How I did that was, you know, I was also a huge fan of the original film. Daniel Wilson was the producer, and both he and Margaret Atwood are producers on our show. So I looked at that footage again, I read the book again, and then I had to put it aside because I am and was such a huge fan. It kind of was stopping me in my tracks. You know, it's like performance anxiety, wanting to make sure that it was as good as every version that has gone before. I think that's a hard one because there's been so many interpretations of the book and also the handmaids themselves. So after struggling with that, I put it aside, and really it was also to get further into the scripts and not get them confused with the novel, which is quite easy to do, as, you know, we tend to do sort of 2 and 3 episodes at a time in terms of preparation. So with The Handmaids, it was looking at as early as the 1700s and moving into 1990s Prada. And what I found was that if I looked at every decade, I would stop along the way at the beginning of every decade because each decade brought very, very clean, purist ideas and lines. And that's what I was looking for. When I met Bruce Miller and Warren Littlefield, our biggest impetus for the series was to find a way to translate these very abstract red robes and white bonnets or wings into a world that looks modern and feels like everyday clothing. And it wasn't very easy to translate. But I think the way to do that, or in my mind, the way to do that was to really investigate the beginnings of every decade and what stayed throughout that decade. It was a really long process. And usually the simplest way was the way in, the lines of clothing that stayed throughout all time, right? And that impetus was also, I mean, maybe slightly egotistical. It was, how do I make this show last so it doesn't also inform people that it's just 2016 or 2017. Mm-hmm. I didn't know, but I had a feeling that we were going to be mirroring a lot of what was happening in society and in politics, and we just wanted it to be a modern story. So all of those things combined led to what you see on the screen.
Sure. And equally, there's an importance of, like, they do serve a function in the world of Gilead as well, that they're lived in clothes and, you know, the shoes don't have shoelaces, for instance, for a very real and distressing reason.
It's basically prison garb. A beautiful, intense color, but those are uniforms for people that are imprisoned. So there's that dark side of the beautiful image that it gives cinematically, you know?
Yeah. And then I guess that leads, of course, to the wives and the look, that, especially for Serena, how she pulls that off. You know, that impeccable tailoring, and, you know, it's so frustrating that regimes and authoritarian regimes always have such impeccable tailoring in their uniforms.
Isn't that funny? Yeah. I agree. It's story related because, you know, I always said that everything had to make sense on screen. We had to really understand that people have their clothes made in a factory except for the 1% that's running things, right? Sure. So anybody that's a commander or a wife, they get their fabric woven for them. They have their own personal tailor. So those tiny details, I really wanted to infer on the screen that they are higher up. In a sense, well, not in a sense, they are higher up, and their clothing should reflect that kind of higher class via tailoring and things being fitted. And, you know, that equals power in a lot of ways. And what's beautiful is when you go all the way like that, then you're able to take that character's power away via the clothing as well, mm-hmm. which is what happened later on in season one. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess
No, I was just thinking about Yvonne being from Australia and how cool it is that you're from Australia and we're talking about her, that's all.
Yeah, it's a nice synergy.
So, yeah, she did such a great job.
Yeah, she does, doesn't she? Yeah. And the middle ground, you know, the villain who keeps them in their place, the aunts, especially dear old Aunt Lydia, that look. Can we talk about what was
that
the thinking
look.
In there? Yeah, that's a quite a look.
Sure. Quite a look, because it is the kind of middle ground where women, the handmaids, and really the handmaids mostly, are being governed by another woman, right? There's not a man right next to them. Mm. It's the aunts. And then beyond the aunts, it's the guardians who are keeping the handmaids in line. So I wanted a very frightening, frightening uniform that would equal the military without taking away the power of the guardians and the eyes, who are quite military. They come straight from the military. So how to keep the ants at a lower level because they're women, but still give them power visually when they're alone with the handmaids. And so that fabric, actually, I did a lot of research into the military, and even fashion versions of, which you can find a lot of, especially from, you know, the beginnings of war until now, like beautifully cut military uniforms. Mm. That costume came from this kind of British brown, it's called British tan, but it's really a brown mm-hmm. military fabric from Scotland. And then we found out season two that it's actually being used at the moment in Canada for their military uniforms, right. Which I didn't know the exact fabric. Funny. And certainly Margaret Atwood, when she was an aunt in season one, she got it right away when she was getting dressed. She said, ah, Hitler,
right.
You know, when she was putting on her uniform as an aunt, her costume. So it does have its roots there via the color and perhaps the shoulders. But beyond that, believe it or not, it was a way to make them uber religious, but also a feminist. So the feminist part came from the TV show Maud.
Oh, right.
Which I grew up with.
Sure, me too.
Beatrice Arthur
yep.
was one of my favorites growing up, and her turtleneck and her really long vest flowing into the room. Yeah. You know, I never quite understood it, but I liked it as a kid, as a young lady. So I kind of threw that into their costume and then gave them two little secrets for good and for evil in their clothing, in their costume. One is a hidden pocket for their cattle prods, which they use to harm the handmaids and keep them in line. And the other is a kind of female genitalia. If you look at their chest up and the collar around, it creates a woman's genitalia. And that was a kind of FU to the patriarchy, yeah. You know, how to empower the women, even though they're being horrible to other women.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of hope for a turnaround in the story, I guess.
Sure. So a little bit like Daniel Day-Lewis in Phantom Thread with the notes in the fabric. You've added little details in the creation.
Yeah, interesting. That's right. Yeah.
And, of course, the costumes themselves have tipped over into real-world settings, and the handmaids in particular, they're a powerful symbol of protest. What's that like, sort of seeing your interpretation of the handmaid outfit being used in real-world settings?
It is unlike anything I've ever experienced in the most beautiful ways. It's surprising and it humbles me, and it is something that I was hired to do as a costume designer for a particular story that I was quite inspired by Margaret Atwood. For that to be used in the story to subjugate women and to have women turn that around and use it for protest, for their voices, personally and collectively, is such an incredibly beautiful outcome, one that I would have never, ever expected. I don't think anybody did. But I would be lying if I said it wasn't incredibly amazing each time I see that happen. I'm so proud. And I'm also smart enough to know that it's not all me. You know, this has taken on a life of its own, and women are finding their own way of expression through utilizing that costume in their own way. So it's beautiful. And you know, I was maybe a seed planted, but I'm not the whole plant. There are so many offshoots.
Sure.
Right?
So. But credit where credit's due, of course.
That's it. Thank you.
And on the flip side, I mean, I don't know if you saw in the news, and I know this had absolutely nothing to do with the show, but I have to ask you, that lingerie line of sexy handmaids inspired knickers that made headlines last week, what did you make of that?
No, my friend who did the first couple episodes, Mark White, is the production designer and one of my dearest best friends, and he texted me and said, WTF, you know, like, what is going on? And yeah. I've just been busy, so yeah. I haven't investigated, but it's funny, it's so crazy, and the answer is I don't know. Yeah. I haven't looked at it yet.
Yeah.
It seems wrong on the surface. Maybe it's an inside joke, and I'll know that when I read it, you know, but
sure.
It's funny.
Yeah, you could not get more removed from the underwear in the show. And, of course, now we're in season two, and there's already a much more of a connection to the real world, and, you know, now June is out. What challenges has that posed for you? You know, she's very ceremoniously burned the robe.
Yeah, that was cool. Yeah. That was very phoenix-like and beautifully empowering visually. You know, it was time, right? In the story, it's time to start a new chapter, and the easiest way to do that is to ceremoniously burn everything that you knew prior.
Yeah.
It's a religious moment, a spiritual religious moment on screen. So listen, it opened up so many different worlds and so many different stories, and it just made me excited for what was to come. It was painful, I'm not going to lie, because it takes forever to make, you know, that whole costume is hours and hours and hours. I mean, just the wings alone takes hours and days, actually, weeks. And so that was painful, you know, but I had to get over that because the story is remarkable. So it's thrilling. It's freedom for your lead and what may come. And the journey that she embarks is at the beginning of a new season. I mean, what could be better than that, you know?
Yeah.
So I loved it. I loved it. I think we were all sort of worried about how we were going to up the ante season two, and the end of season one was left on such a question that I think we all were sort of crossing our fingers all summer, and praying for the best.
Yeah.
So hopefully we got there. We'll see. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, look, we are here for it. And thank you so much. It's such a thrill to talk to you because I'm a closed nut anyway, but in this show particularly, yeah, honestly, it's a real thrill.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. It never gets old to hear, so I thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I kind of say that if we are interviewing people from The Handmaid's Tale, can we just put in a request for Max Minghella? I did a little bit of a deep dive on him last week because I couldn't help myself.
You're joining me in the Max Minghella
I am totally there with you. I was relieved to find out that he's actually 32. He looks so young. I thought he better not still be in college. But 32, thank you. Actually, his dad is quite famous.
Oh, yes, Anthony Minghella.
Anthony Minghella, who wrote and directed The English Patient. Mm.
His sister also works in sort of the film industry.
Yeah. Like he's coming from like a multi-Oscar winning household. So he's got some acting chops behind him. What I did find funny, I saw an interview with him. First thing is that he calls Elizabeth Moss Lizzie.
Lizzie. Well, that's how she sort of Lizzie, signs off on all of her Instagrams and the rest too.
It just feels so wrong. In my mind, she's Ms. Moss.
Elizabeth. Well, she's taken over the Instagram account
for
of
Hulu.
The Handmaid's Hulu over the past week, which has got some great behind the scenes, especially of the iconic singlet and the blood streaks.
Yeah, yep.
Aftermath
exactly.
of cutting off the ear.
So what's going to happen next, guys?
Oh, boy. Cliffhanger.
Of course, it was too good to be true. She couldn't really be leaving to freedom quite yet, could she?
Yeah, well, we do have another 10 episodes to go. It's
and I'm surprised more people, we haven't actually seen more people die in this episode that helped her. Because every time someone was coming to help her, I was like, oh, this nice man's about to get it. Mm. And the pilot obviously does, but.
Yeah. And you mentioned Natalie seeing men fleeing Gilead. Mm. We also saw a driver who was on his way out as well, who shared the plane with June. Yeah.
Yeah. What is going to happen next? And I think my fear is that I really don't want her to end up back at the commander's house. But I kind of feel like she sort of has to, otherwise we don't see them again and we need to see them again. So, but in my dreams, the next episode will open with Nick arriving and taking out all those three guards and whisking her off to safety. But, you know, the show's not done yet.
Well, I also thought Luke's first line in this episode was that there's military exercises along the border. So I'm thinking hopefully maybe – I know it's not them because they shot the pilot. These are Gilead guards that came in there at the end. But, you know, maybe they're close enough to the border that there might be some
– And he remarks it's like 1775 again. Yeah. And I was like, what happened in 1775? I sort of – I went to Google that because I was like, that's not when the White House was burnt down. My North American history needs some refreshing. And that's actually when the American Revolution first started and kicked off and the rebellion sort of started in Massachusetts. So that's what he was referring to when it's 1775 again.
Yeah.
Thanks, Google. But I was going to say, as the plane's about to take off and the camera's sort of on her as she's sort of saying her voiceover about letting go of Hannah and hoping, you know, having done the best she could. And she's sort of making peace with that decision as she's about to take off. It kind of reminded me of the first episode when she's about to be hung. And again, the camera's on her as she's tearing up and making peace with the end of her life. And both times it's sort of, oh, hang on. That's not what's happening. Tricked you. Mm-hmm. It's so painful to watch.
It's a roller coaster. It really is. And the music as well, the way it triggers things in you and how it just sounds like moaning sometimes and I would like to interview the music director. It really is, And the Nick theme as well, that the Nick music comes in, you know, usually when they're about to get it on, but
I hadn't noticed that he had a musical theme. I actually hadn't noticed that at all.
Quickly learned up Spotify.
And then I realised it comes in here, but Nick's not there. And it's sort of like, I guess it's the theme of when something, there's an opportunity or something's going askew and it's not quite on the path of Gilead, it's a little something to the side. And it's here when she takes the path off in her grey outfit and is running randomly, just trying to, she wants to go, but the guilt is kicking in.
Oh, she's flashing back to losing Hannah in the woods.
Yeah, and it's quite a remarkable difference to the running she was doing at the start of the episode where it was very directed and pure cardio. Here it's, am I going or am I not? What's going on? So, that theme kicked in then.
Because I think that she actually is torn. She doesn't really know whether she wants to leave or not. And I think that's really hard because once you leave the country, you're leaving your daughter behind. Where are you best positioned to save her? Are you better off being in the country or out of the country? So as she was leaving, I don't think that she was quite at peace with that decision, though she was trying to get there.
Struggling to make peace.
Yeah, so now I'm very nervous about what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, if she's captured, ordinarily she might go to the colonies, but she is a pregnant handmaid.
Exactly, she has it on her side.
I don't think that's her fate quite yet.
She does have the option because those guys were killing pretty quickly and they weren't taking a lot of time to interrogate. And I thought they could just shoot her very, very fast before they even realise that she's pregnant. So I wonder whether she'll have to show her belly to save herself. She has the option of not saving herself, which is what that O'Connor wife was getting towards. I wouldn't be able to give up my baby. I would rather die first. And I thought the episode has ended with her having that choice of how is she going to handle this. Anyway, it's all a bit much.
It is. It always is.
Well, thanks for letting us talk this through. We hope this helped you as much as it's helped us. We're going to be doing this every week, every time a new episode drops at SBS and SBS On Demand every Thursday. And after Handmaid's screens on SBS Thursday nights, we're also premiering a new drama called Next of Kin, which stars Archie Punjabi, who you may know from The Good Wife or Bend It Like Beckham, as a woman dealing with her radicalised nephew in London. That's also available at SBS On Demand. Thanks for your response to this show. We're loving hearing your responses to it.
Tweet us.
Feel free. And do feel free to leave a review and give us a rating wherever you get your podcasts from. We love to see what you think. You might also like some other SBS podcasts we do. There's a weekly recap of The Good Fight, The Good Fight podcast hosted by Dan Barrett and Sarah Malik, and our weekly movies and TV podcast, The Playlist, hosted by myself and my colleague Nick Bassine. For more on The Handmaid's Tale, you can head to SBS Guide, where we've got episode recaps and full coverage. And if you'd like to follow us on social media, you can find me on Twitter at anythingbutfifi.
I'm on Twitter as well at Sana_Qadar, Qadar.
And I'm on Twitter as at Natalie Hambley.
And our producer is Dan Barrett, and audio and mixing by Jeremy Wilmot. Thanks for listening. You don't own me.
Are you brave or stupid?
I'm not brave, so.
And until next time, don't let the bastards grind you down.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.